It gives me great pleasure to introduce Joey C. from Orchid.
Hi, I'm Joey. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Joey.
Can I get a volunteer to keep Sarah in line tonight? Okay, thank you. Sarah asked me before the meeting if I was nervous, and I talk in front of groups for work all the time, and as long as I know what I'm talking about, if I'm training on something I've studied, no problem. And you might think I'd be an expert on this subject, but I wasn't there for a lot of it. So this is trying to kind of, there are a lot of blanks, a lot of filling in the gaps, and I will do the best I can. So in 2010, I was sitting in a bar, pregnant, with a drink in my hand, absolutely terrified because I knew I couldn't stop. And I had stayed sober through my pregnancy, and the doctor recommended that I have a glass of wine before bed to relax me. And I just thought that was great news. So I went to the bar, and I got that glass, and I drank it. And right then, that obsession kicked in, and I knew I wasn't going to stop. So that night, I went to the Lion's Den. It was a Tuesday night. I went to the Orchid Lion's Den meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I haven't had a drink since. So that was December 13th, 2010. And I don't know if it's okay to have two home groups, but I kind of have two home groups. I've got the Sunday Pyramid Group and the Tuesday Lion's Den. I love them both. I'm there at both of them whenever I can be. My sponsor is Suzanne Newman. I had four sponsors in my first 5 years, and it took me a while to find the person that was really the best for me to work with. And I thank my higher power that I had every one of those sponsors. They all taught me really great lessons. So let's see. When I was a kid, I was always getting in trouble for dancing in the grocery store. I'd be doing back walkovers and cartwheels on the soccer field, you know, just kind of in my own little world. And things were good. My folks took us camping all the time. I got to spend a couple weeks up in the Sierras carrying everything on my back that I needed. And I got to have some really, really neat experiences. When I came into the program, I had a really hard time with the concept of a higher power. I had believed that this, my life and the mess that I'd made of it was God's fault. And when I started going back and doing the work and looking back at my life, God was with me from the very start. I think I was about 8 years old when I was aware that God was in my life. I was terrified of the dark. I would turn on all the lights in the whole house, go all the way to the kitchen and start turning them off one by one as I got closer to my bedroom. Then I'd turn it off, run, jump into bed, cover up, and shook until I fell asleep. And one night I got on my knees and I prayed that God would take away that fear of the dark. And sometime later, I don't know if it was a couple of weeks, I was aware that I'd been getting into bed normally, and I hadn't tried, I hadn't thought about it, I hadn't said, oh, I prayed, so now I must be able to do it. You know, it was just looking back, I realized that fear had been taken away. And that's what this program has been like for me. I can't look back at the steps and see exactly how my life changed and how I got this second chance, but I definitely did. Let's see. When things started getting rough for me as a kid, was when I started to feel not enough. I started to feel criticized. My folks were really overprotective, and I had to do things just right. And I felt like every time someone gave me a suggestion, I heard, you're not good enough. You can't do it right. You're worthless. You're unloved. Now, that's not what they said. They said, you know, maybe you want to be a little more careful so you don't break that next time you try to put dishes away, you know. But to me, that message was very different, and I'm not sure why that was. But it became really difficult, and I had a model at home of, I had a very passive mom. You know, anytime I asked about something, can I do this, it was, go ask your dad, or there'd be the little triangulation, well, it's okay with me if your dad says yes, you know, but why don't you go ask him, and wait until this time to ask him, and there was a lot of stuff going on at home that I didn't quite understand. Like, I knew that an hour before my dad got home from work, my mom would start panicking, and we'd have to clean the house really fast. She called it the Speedy Maids game, and then we had to have his water boiling when he walked in the door for his coffee, and then we'd have to be sitting on the floor waiting to take his boots off when he came in, and, you know, things like this that didn't make a lot of sense to me, and I grew up in a physically abusive home and didn't know it at the time. You know, for me it was normal life, and in it, I don't see it. You know, it wasn't until looking back on it and talking with other people that I could say I was in a physically abusive home without saying but. And you know, so I say that, and my husband, I'm sure most people know, my husband is a big circuit speaker. He travels all over the country and speaks, and he says a good speaker never keeps notes. Well, I'm not a good speaker, so I have notes. but the biggest thing I think growing up is that I grew up with a father who had PTSD. He was not alcoholic. But a lot of the relationship issues that I had to deal with growing up were pretty significant, and not knowing what he had gone through, you know, I was very very critical of him, you know, put a lot of blame on him, and you know, if only my dad had been more loving, or if only my dad, you know, and in my memories, my dad never showed me affection or love. You know, and a while back I was going through some stuff in the attic, and I found this letter from a camp, a Girl Scout camp I was at, and this letter was so tender, you know, to my dad. I love you, Dad, you know, can't wait to come home, miss my nighttime hug, you know, and I, you know, just, I hadn't remembered any of that. So, you know, it's interesting the things that I blocked out, and I had to really search for the good things, but there were a lot. There were a lot of really good things. And somebody told me once, you know, with alcoholics, the good stuff slides off like an egg on a Teflon skillet, and the bad stuff sticks like Velcro. You know, those are the things that I remember and hold on to. And I started drinking, really drinking, probably about 14. For me, it was a total way of isolating. I would put headphones on with heavy metal, turn the volume up all the way, start drinking, crawl under the bed, you know, pull the blankets down so I had my little enclosure, and I would just stay under the bed a lot of the time, you know, and just kind of hide under there, and then you know, Mom would come in and say, "You want to join us for dinner?" You know, and I'd scream at her for interrupting my isolation. You know, it was just my little safe place, and I was put into Klein Bottle, which I don't think it's around anymore, but it was a an alcoholic treatment residential facility for teens, and in there I really went crazy because except for the times when I snuck out, I didn't drink, I didn't have my drink, and I was just really, you know, walking around with all this anger and all these feelings that didn't have any situations associated with them. Like, I didn't know why I was feeling this stuff. It was just there, and I didn't know what to do with it. And so I started being self-destructive, you know, and you know, doing the carving on myself and stuff. And that was a relief without alcohol. It helped. And someone at the Klein bottle told my parents I needed to be hospitalized because of that. And so they came to Klein bottle. We were in the upstairs room with therapists, and they told me I was being involuntarily committed to an adolescent substance abuse hospital in Port Hueneme. And I said, fine, you can do what you want. I don't care, as long as I get out of here and get a drink first. That's all I really need to deal with this right now. I just need a drink. And I tried to jump out that second story window, and they had to sit on me and keep me there. But that was all I could think, is if I can only get a drink, everything's going to be okay. And so I got out, and that was my first introduction to AA. Everyone from the hospital had to go to these alumni meetings, and those were 12-step meetings. I don't know that they were specific to Alcoholics Anonymous. I think they were just kind of, you know, general 12-step. But that was my first introduction to the program. And then, you know, things went on. I was arrested a couple of times, kicked out of school, put in probation school. I overdosed, drank too much, ended up in the hospital with a 50% chance of my liver repairing itself. And, you know, and all this was in my young teenage years. And, you know, one thing I remember is my friends, even the friends that drank a lot with me, always telling me, you're losing your edge. You know, and that's kind of the line of my life. In all different decades, I would hear people saying, you're losing your edge, you're taking it too far. And, you know, or you're willing to pay the price, but you don't count the cost. You know, like, I gotta have this at all costs, no matter what, I'm willing to pay. You know, but I never thought about who that hurt, and or what the actual cost might be. So, when I got my first job after all of this stuff happened, my sponsor in AA, Shirley Mazzucatelli, she's still around. She helped me get a job at a gas station, and that was such an uncomfortable thing for me to be in a, you know, dealing with people all day without my drink, you know. And I started carrying a flask with me to work every day. So I was like 19, working at a gas station, carrying a flask in my purse and drinking all day. And that job didn't last long. In fact, I was looking back on my work history recently, and I can't think of one job. Maybe my very, very first job. But other than that, I can't think of a job that I didn't leave on some kind of negative terms. You know, whether it was being let go because I was drinking on the job, or not showing up because I was drunk, or going out on disability so that I didn't get fired. You know, I had some jobs that really made me happy. They were, you know, they were fulfilling. And yet all of them ended this way. Did you know that you can't drink at your desk when you work for Child Welfare Services? Who knew? So, I tried to control it. I tried to keep from losing that edge so many times, and I would end up passed out on the bathroom floor at work. You know, always having bottles in my, you know, that bottom file drawer on your desk with the key. That was my little, that's where I had all my bottles. And at one job I worked with a therapist and some other people, and I'd been sober for about 5 years. Not sober, but I hadn't drank in 5 years. And I went to a birthday party with some coworkers from this job, and everybody was ordering these you know, martinis and stuff like this, and I hadn't drank in 5 years. I'd come into the program in 2000, and I'd done okay, and I got married, and I had this great job, and I thought, you know, I can probably drink again. And I ordered a drink, and then about 6 times throughout the course of that lunch, I excused myself to the restroom, was really going over to the bar around the corner to have a shot. And that night, I that night I blacked out, and you know, that night turned out to be one of the most shameful of my of all my drinking. And that's when I saw the progression of this disease. You know, that first drink after a long period of not drinking, and you know, and I don't know. I'm tempted to tell you what happened, but TMI. Okay.
Yeah.
So it was rough, all right? It was rough. So it seemed like, you know, every few years things would fall apart. Things would get really bad. And I started trying different things. At one point I decided I was only going to drink at special dinners. If I had wine, champagne, I was out at a nice restaurant overlooking the ocean, something like that, it would be okay to drink. So I started taking myself out to dinner at this restaurant. I swear to God, I even bought myself a rose one night on the way. And I would sit there overlooking the ocean, and I would order salads and drink and drink and drink and drink and drink. And things got out of hand again really, really fast. And so then I woke up one morning and I said, I'm going back to AA. I know this works. I've been here before. And I had been here before, but I had never gone past about half of step four. And I always asked people to sponsor me who were either like friends, somebody I wanted to hang out with, and this is a really good excuse to, you know, have somebody to hang out with, or someone that intimidated me. And, you know, it's easier to go up to someone who intimidates you and says, will you help me, you know, and have that relationship rather than, I don't know if you understand that, but that's what I did when I was in here as a kid. And so one morning I woke up, decided I was going to go back to AA. And I also said, I'm going to get a job today. And I called somebody and I told them, I'm going to get a job today. And they said, you mean you're going to look for a job today? I said, no, I'm going to get a job today. And I did. I went to a nursing facility, and I turned in my resume, got hired, started working. And my resumes were a little creative. I embellished a little bit. Like, everything was true, but I may have done something. Like, I helped write a grant one time back in 1996, and so I put grant successful experience with grant writing. So it sounds like I'm just this grant writer, done it all the time, you know, really good at it. So these are the kinds of things that I did on my resume. And after I was there a couple of weeks, the director came to me and said, you know, we have this director position open in Morro Bay, and you seem qualified for it. So would you like it? And how much do you want us to pay you? And so I took that job, and my ego got huge instantly, and I wasn't drinking. I was going to AA, and then one day, that one day came when I could have just a drink, you know, just take that edge off. And within a matter of a couple of months, I had been hiring my drinking buddies to work with me so that we could drink there at night, and you know, and I was passing out in the residence in the rooms at the facility, and I was renting this house in Morro Bay, and you know, I made a disaster of everything, and people cared about me and they tried to help, and my response to them was, mind your own business, you're in my space here, you know. And I had no thought of what I was putting other people through. And so I left that in the middle of the night, you know, took my stuff and just kind of disappeared at midnight. Never knew if I was going to get, you know, arrested for some of the things I had done there. And, you know, I was stealing the patients' medications and selling them on the street and, you know, this kind of thing. And the gig was up, and I didn't know what was going to happen. I just ran away in the night like I did, you know, from a lot of places. And so I came back to Orchid, lived in a trailer in the alley, and out in Old Orchid. And once again, things got out of hand. And this last period after coming back to Orchid, was, you know, like I talk about the progression and how I had that one drink and then, you know, things just were worse than they'd ever been. Well, I didn't know they could get worse than that, and they did. And I caused a lot of pain. And when I work with sponsees on the first step, sometimes I'll have people write down, you know, what are your values? What are your goals? What's important to you in life? And how did drinking get in the way of that? And for me, I had, you know, my five-year-old that I have right now is my only child. So back then it was a poodle, a little brown poodle, just like the one I have now. And he was my kid. I had him for 13 years. And that dog, I was one of those crazy dog people who dress their dogs up in clothes and take them everywhere with you. So I loved this dog. And yet I put him in a cage one night to run to the liquor store and came back 4 days later. And he had no food or water. You know, I drove out to Colson Canyon and left him there. Drove all the way back to town before I realized he wasn't with me. Burned an apartment down with him inside. And, you know, all these things. And again, these are all instances where God showed up in my life and did far more for me than I deserved. And that dog lived to be, you know, an old poodle. He died of old age, if you can believe that. But that's how drinking interfered with a lot in my life. And when I was 36, I was drinking every day. I was waking up, pulling the bottle out from under the bed, having to drink to get in the shower to go to work. I would, you know, go to the bar at lunchtime, you know, not stop there, pass out in an empty office, and then drive home, stop at the liquor store. They'd keep a bottle in the freezer for me for the drive home, go home, keep drinking, blackout, do it all again the next day. And this was life for me. And then at 36, I had this panic, you know, I'm never going to be a mother. So I decided I wanted to be. So I wrote a letter to my boyfriend at the county jail, and I said, let's have a kid. He says, great idea, okay. So he got out, and I got pregnant with my daughter, Abby Rose. And when I was, I don't know, maybe, I don't know, but I remembered the kind of mother that I had. And she was, you know, she was a good mom. You know, she was loving, she took care of us. She, maybe a little too enabling, a little too enmeshed, but she was always like my best friend. And I wanted that relationship with my own daughter. So that's when I decided that I was going to, you know, I was done. I was just done. I wanted to be a mom. I wanted to have a life that didn't keep crumbling to pieces every couple of years. And once again, I knew where to come, because even before I was an alcoholic, before I was ready for this program, I was accepted and welcomed here. And so I came in here that night after leaving the bar, and I got a sponsor right away. Her name was Dominique, and she was an artist, and she took me through my steps very quickly. I didn't do a good job on my steps. They were the best I could do at the time, but it was enough to keep me sober, because prior to that, I was absolutely terrified of the doorbell. I was terrified of the phone ringing. I couldn't look in the mailbox. I couldn't go to the grocery store, because if I did, I'd see somebody that brought up some kind of negative feelings, and I'd be ducking and hiding and running around the aisles. It was no way to live. It was absolute insanity for me. When I did those steps, it was like taking in a breath of air. You know, I could do it. I could go to the store. And I did run into people there that I had a lot of wreckage with. And I walked up to them, and I said hello, and I kept walking. And then later, when I was ready, I made amends to those people. But I'm really grateful for that first sponsor. Like I said, she was an artist. So when I was struggling with my God concept, I was on vacation, in Palm Springs with my folks in a motorhome, and there was a huge storm. And you know, the desert storm was, I mean, it was really powerful, and huge black clouds were rolling across the sky, and lightning, and all this stuff. And that was my first softening point toward a higher power, was that I cannot control what's going on in this sky. It is something way beyond me. You know, there's nothing I can do to make any difference in what's happening up there. And so that's how it started. You know, the weather, the storm, whatever was my entryway back into my belief. And she had me do some art projects, make some necklace that symbolized my concept of a higher power, and it was really neat. And that was a gift that she gave me. And my second sponsor, who I'm really glad is here tonight, Lynn, she taught me about service. She taught me about humility. She taught me about being a worker among workers instead of getting that big head and wanting to rise to positions that I wasn't qualified for. You know, it was okay to just be me. And she taught me that service isn't just about, you know, cleaning up in here. Every time I turned around, she was busy out helping somebody who needed it, whether they were in the program or not. And that was an example that I've been really grateful for. So when I was new, I had this little infant, and I had no idea what to do. I didn't know how to stay sober, let alone be a sober mom. And my parents went on a vacation, and I had moved back in with them, and I was alone trying to stay sober with this child. And Lynn and Sarah and other women, seven women, took shifts with me 2 hours every day. They would come over and help me out and teach me how to stay sober and how to be a mom. And I like to share that because that's when I belonged to AA. It was when I asked for help and then accepted it. And every single one of those women is still sober today and still a friend of mine today. And Sarah went a little above and beyond, I got to tell you. She was my Lamaze partner. She rubbed my cantaloupe feet. We sat in my car by candlelight outside an Alcoholics Anonymous convention pumping my breath. I mean, you talk about service.
She had a pump.
So asking for help was huge, and then when I was, you know, I don't know, maybe a year or two sober, I don't really remember, I think actually I was newer than that, I was the lucky subject of gossip in the program, you know, and my sponsor called me to tell me about it. She told me, you know, so-and-so is saying you did this, this, and that, and this, and you know, I was mad. You know, people were talking about my dirty laundry in here, and first of all, it was all true, but I was intoxicated at the time. But I called Erica, my third sponsor, and I told her about it, And she just said, take a deep breath. What other people think of you is none of your business. You know? It's just not. And I had to let that go. And I didn't do an inventory on it right then. I wasn't that familiar with everything. But just that piece and her letting me know that, you know, it just didn't matter. I couldn't think about that. I had other things to focus on. And then... There's one thing that I gotta take a drink here. Hold on. Coffee. If this is being recorded, that's a drink of coffee. By the way, thank you for the monster. So one day it was my nephew's birthday or something. We were having a barbecue at the beach, and I was over at my parents' house getting ready to go, and my dad said something insignificant, seemingly, but what he said, it just triggered all the negative childhood stuff, and what he said just tore me apart, and I didn't know what to do. They left without me, and I was just full of anger and sadness, and I called my sponsor, and I said this happened, and I don't know what to do about it. And she told me to go to the barbecue, act as if everything's fine, just act as if, and we'd deal with it later. And that I believe that could have been the right thing, but that's not what I did. I did a fourth step on it. I wrote it out. I wrote out what he said, how it affected me, what my part in it was, and I prayed and I cried and I yelled at his picture on the wall and I got it all out. And when I went to that barbecue, I was probably an hour and a half late, but when I got there, I was able to walk up to him and apologize for my part in it and sincerely expect nothing from him. I didn't need any apology from him. It was okay on a gut level. It was okay. So I learned something that day on how to handle things that come up in sobriety. I've had a few growing moments in here, and one of them came not so long ago. I'd been at my job for about 3 years, good at it, comfortable in it, and I got an offer for a promotion that I was not qualified for. I felt I wasn't qualified for it. So I was talking to people. I'm like, I'm really comfortable where I'm at. I don't want to take this risk. What if I fail? And some people told me, maybe you should just pass, play it safe, And I talked to Leo. And Leo said, if you stay where you're at, you're not going to grow. If you stay comfortable, you're not going to grow. And so I applied for that job. I took that risk. I got it. And oh boy, have I been growing! I would have to give these big presentations in meetings full of people that really intimidated me, and in my head I would see everything going so smoothly, and all the things I would say, and everybody would just be like, "Wow, we're so glad we hired her," and what came out of my mouth in meetings was absolutely awful, and I was just, I left red-faced and ashamed, and I just want to quit, And again, I asked God. I said, if this is where you want me, please help me do your work here. And in a short time, I was getting feedback from my supervisors that the reports I was giving were good and appropriate. And so even in the little things, my higher power has been there throughout my life. One other thing that's happened recently, it's a little scary to share up here, but the book talks about alcohol in any form, that I can't take alcohol in any form. And up until recently, I had decided that, that's for me to decide if I take a cold medicine that has alcohol in it, or, salad dressing that has alcohol in it, or something that's been cooked with beer. I mean, people are on all, everywhere on the spectrum on whether that's okay. And my belief is that it's an individual choice of, what you eat and things like that. And I took cold medicine. I had the flu, and I took that, and the taste of alcohol in that cough syrup and that medicine started the obsession for me again in sobriety. And the obsession was so incredibly strong, and it really scared me. I was so close, and trying to keep it to myself because I don't want to embarrass my husband with 28 years, and I don't want to admit to all of you that, you know, that the obsession came back and how insanely crazy I was in my thinking and not sharing that almost took me out, keeping that to myself. And, you know, and I came here one night and I talked to Sarah about it. You know, Sarah was there for me. I have to tell you, I was in a dress like this with my heels on, and Sarah's in her, you know, her working out in the field clothes, and I've got her arm like this, and we walked around this whole block probably 3 times, and you wouldn't believe the looks that we were getting from people.
Yeah.
You know, but the power of one alcoholic talking with another, and she told me, you know, that monster's deflated now. You know, and she was right. It wasn't hard to talk about after that, as hard to talk about after that. And I'm so grateful for everybody in here. I see a lot of family. I've known Joey, 16 years, and Mario, and you know, I have grown up in here. I used to hear Kaylin say that, and I really liked how she shared that, that sometimes we have to grow up publicly, and I definitely have. One last thing, and then I think I'm going to quit early. I did better. I went down to Santa Barbara one time to speak not so long ago, and it was like an hour and 15-minute meeting. I talked for 20 minutes, and I was done. I was just done. So I sat down. But... I had been married in the program before, and when I relapsed, I did a lot of damage, and I had not had very high expectations of what my life could be at the time, and there was a moment when it felt like everything was just, you know, over and gone in my life. You know, my job, I'd lost everything. You know, I went from the wonderful house I was living in to staying in a house with 4 other couples with concrete floors and snakes and turtles for pets. I mean, this was the kind of places my drinking took me to. And somebody relates. But when I came in here and really started doing the work, I met with my current sponsor one night, and I had been really crazy. I had been out of a relationship for a couple of years, and then, you know, in some, I don't know. Anyway, we'll skip that. So I met with my sponsor, and we did a sex inventory, something that I hadn't done before in detail. And we drove around in her truck for a couple hours, and I just read the darn thing to her, and all of the humiliating, embarrassing, you know, all of the obsessions, all of that stuff that you know, that we go through when we're growing up in AA. And that helped me so much. I grew so much from that, because after that I was able to talk about things with her, and I was able to start to develop healthy relationships, and you know, today I have more than I could have ever dreamed of. You know, my daughter is wonderful and smart, and you know, my husband is so amazing. You know, we get up in the morning, and he grabs my hand and prays, and then we have coffee together, and we talk about real things, you know, and then my daughter comes down, and we all have family time together, and, you know, he makes her lunch, and I take her to school, and, you know, and I say before I had low expectations of what my life could be, and it was risky to live again, you know, because when I was drinking, I was just I was satisfied with nothing. Just as long as I can have my drink, I don't need or want anything else. And that was a lie that alcohol told me. And since I've been in here, the blessings, they just don't stop coming, you know. My family is amazing. My God is amazing. There's so many things that happen in my life that are far from coincidences, you know. And I'm just really, really grateful and blessed to be here and to have family here and people who will keep me away from that drink, even at 5 years sobriety when I'm way too close to it. And so that's all I've got. Thank you so much.